From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's most outspoken linguist has a bone to pick with America. Noam Chomsky has made a long and in-your-face career out of messing with the establishment and challenging the powerful. Since September 11th, the radical advocate for human freedom is again critiquing the world's greatest and most powerful establishment, the United States itself. Chomsky says when America uses its influence and power to contribute to repression and coercion around the world, it is his responsibility to speak out. Tonight, Noam Chomsky, linguist, radical left-wing political philosopher, freedom fighter, on the meaning of 9/11. Begin with the latest on Capitol Hill. The Senate opened up debate on U.S. energy policy for the first time in 10 years, with Republicans and Democrats clashing over how to make the country less reliant on foreign oil. Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him about the position of the Bush administration in the energy policy debate.
Well, the White House has offered up its own energy proposal. A large extent of that was passed by the House. They are sitting back, though, at the moment. We know what they support, but they're not actively lobbying, in large part because they know that the Senate is not going to pass the plan that they want, and the Senate is going to pass a completely different one.
The heart of the White House proposal, of course, was going into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Well,
are you saying that that's not going to happen? They can see the writing on the wall?
No, and it's the most discussed element of it. It's probably not the heart of it. The heart of it is vast encouragements for energy production and transmission all over the country, whereas opponents are favoring more conservation and alternative fuels measures instead. Now, the ANWR is certainly the most controversial part of that, and a number of Democratic senators, John Kerry among them, have said they will filibuster and they will just not let this happen, plain and simple. So I think both sides pretty much know that ANWR is not going to happen.
Dana, that is an interesting perspective, however. Do you know what percentage of the increased domestic production the Bush administration would like to see they would have come from ANWR? Would it not be the greatest single source of this increased domestic supply?
Well, you know, if you have 100 increased sources in a domestic area, and you know, one is, I mean, conceivably it could be in that, but it's not the lion's share of the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
The largest share of the proposal is incentives to produce energy. I mean, to bring natural gas down from Canada. You know, the cumulative effects of these incentives are far larger than ANWR.
Mm-hmm. And the Democrats' approach is quite different. They want greater fuel economy regulated on the American automobile industry, I guess.
Right. The administration has not firmly put itself where it stands on the CAFE standards, as they're known, and that's a large part of the Democratic plan. They're also talking about conservation and certain targets for energy self-sufficiency, in a long-term plan, like 20 years, to have a large amount of our energy produced domestically. They're also talking about a lot of alternative fuels, a whole bunch of tax incentives to encourage conservation. Each side has elements of the other's plan. It's just really a question of emphasis.
But in terms of emphasis, it's Republicans in production, Democrats in conservation. Are the Republicans making an appeal to labor unions, trying to end run the Democrats on this, promising more jobs with greater production?
That's how the proposal got through the House, with the help of the Teamsters. They helped pass the ANWR provision. A lot of people thought that couldn't happen, but they were able to bring some of the blue-collar Democrats along. Less ability to do that in the Senate because of the way it's composed. But there's no doubt that they've skillfully used the Teamsters in particular to pass the plan.
Is there much sense of political pressure to pass some kind of plan at this point? The California energy crisis is behind us. Energy supplies appear plentiful. Gasoline prices are not so high. Has the pressure gone out of the cooker here?
Yes, to an extent, and I think an even larger factor is the whole Enron debacle. And, we have these lawsuits going on between the Congress and the administration trying to find out whether energy executives from Enron and others shape the administration's energy policies. So the Enron taint is involved in so much here, and that is, I think, cowed some of the supporters of energy expansion and deregulation, which is what Enron stood for. before. So the combination of that and the end of the California crisis has definitely taken a lot of wind out of the sails.
Dana Milbank, when you put all these factors together, it appears that you're describing a situation in which nothing's likely to happen on energy policy.
Well, yes, that's probably true of just about any policy that the Congress debates here in Washington. They're going to have to come up with some sort of proposals. They'll probably be rather modest ones. Everybody agrees on tax incentives for hybrid vehicles, research to have fuel cell vehicles, you know, certain common sense changes to improve efficiency of energy transmission. But no, we're not talking about some radical overhaul of energy policy that anybody would really notice.
And if nothing is passed in either direction, are we likely to see this emerge as a campaign issue this fall with Republicans beating up on Democrats and vice versa over their energy stance?
Both sides are prepared to do that. Larger issues will probably be the war, Social Security. So there's been a little loss of interest in energy as an issue. But obviously the Democrats are always eager to bring up the environment as an issue. And the Republicans will make it a national security issue, which is strong for them. So undoubtedly that will be in the campaign.
And from the environmentalist perspective, for now the Alaskan Refuge appears to be secure.
They believe so, and the opponents are pretty much of that same impression. The White House has not formally acknowledged it, but most people think that's sort of a formality.
Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. In his new book, 9/11, Noam Chomsky is not apologizing for the terrorists who struck at America last September. But then again, he's not afraid to place a share of responsibility on the United States either. The U.S., he says, is itself a leading terrorist state and has one of the most extreme fundamentalist religious cultures in the world. Tonight, turning the tables on America's mainstream vision of itself and the world, is the United States a terrorist nation? Would the world be better off if the U.S. backed off and let other countries breathe? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Good evening and welcome, Noam Chomsky.
Hello.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Noam Chomsky, you have a new book out. It's a collection of interviews that you've done with press, much of it foreign press, since September 11th, 2001, covering a wide range of issues from where power lies in the New World Order, how it's wielded, what 9/11 means. We'd like to jump in with you, if we could, right there. You've written so much over so many years. You're an icon and idolized by your admirers and bitterly attacked by your opponents. Where, from your radical, and I don't know if you would call it a left wing, but from your clearly in the American mainstream, your radical view of the society and the global world order, why did 9/11 happen?
Well, I wouldn't consider my views on this at all radical. In fact, they're rather conservative. I agree with almost everyone else that have from the beginning. It's very likely that the perpetrators were the Al-Qaeda network or another very much like them. Nobody understands them better than the CIA and the U.S. military. They helped organize, arm, and train them 20 years ago for their own purposes. The special forces who are seeking to kind of dig them out of Tora Bora are the same special forces who trained them in the 1980s. They've been telling us very clearly what they intend. Bin Laden, who's at least this kind of spiritual leader, has been very outspoken about it. And their actions pretty well correspond to very much correspond to what they say. So I think there's every reason to take it seriously, as I suppose all the world's intelligence agencies do. What they say and what they do and have been doing for 20 years their first terrorist act was 20 years ago when they murdered President Sadat. What they've been saying is fighting to, in their words, drive the infidels out of Muslim lands and bring the Muslim world to a form of extremist orthodoxy that the U.S. in fact supported very strongly in the 1980s, but has now turned against the United States.
So that's the who of who's behind 9/11 and a bit of their individual why. But you know that the mainstream interpretation in the United States today, if I could summarize, and I'm hesitant to, but it's something along the lines of the United States, a benevolent superpower, was going on its innocent merry way, doing business, trying to bring free trade and prosperity to the world, when it was, in its innocence, savagely and entirely wrongly attacked without cause, etc. Do you see that as the mainstream view, and what of that do you buy, if anything?
It may be the mainstream, I suppose it's the view of among intellectual elites. It's certainly not the view among strategic analysts, the serious press like the Wall Street Journal, which to its credit has dealt with this issue seriously, commentators in the professional journals and so on, nor is it the fact. I mean, the question, why do they hate us, which George Bush asked, that has been answered repeatedly. This is not talking about Al-Qaeda now. Mm-hmm. They have their own reasons, but about the general background of, if not support, but kind of sympathetic understanding, if you like, from which the terrorist groups come. A couple of days after September 11th, the Wall Street Journal, I think, was the first to publish a serious review of opinion among what they called moneyed Muslims, so the wealthy sectors in the Islamic world. That means bankers, lawyers, professionals, people running multinational corporations, all completely involved in the U.S. system, and in fact, bin Laden's main enemies. And they described why there's such antagonism to the United States. Namely, they said that it's because of the U.S. support for corrupt and brutal regimes, which undermine democracy and development, and for particular policies like the support for the quite harsh and brutal Israeli military occupation, which relies entirely on U.S. diplomatic and military support, has for 35 years. The sanctions against Iraq, which they understand very well, are devastating the population but strengthening Saddam Hussein. And they remember, though we choose to forget, that the U.S. and Britain supported him through his worst crimes and, in fact, beyond. Furthermore, this is nothing new about this. 10 years ago, when the records for the 1950s were declassified, I wrote about it from declassified records. In 1958, Eisenhower identified three major crises for the United States and the world: Indonesia, North Africa, and the Middle East, all Islamic countries, all oil producers. And he pointed out, this is almost a quote, there is a campaign of hatred against us, not from the governments, but from the people. And that was discussed. The National Security Council gave its highest planning body, gave its analysis around the same time. It said something like this: there's a perception in that region that the United States is supporting harsh, corrupt regimes which are undermining democracy and development, and is doing so because of its interest in controlling Near East oil. Then they added that this perception is difficult to counter because it's correct. And furthermore, it ought to be correct. That's what we ought to be doing. That was 45 years ago. It's exactly the same as what virtually the same as what the Wall Street Journal discovered a couple of days after September 11th, when it interviewed people who are very much part of the U.S. system.
So do you see 9/11, Noam Chomsky, as an inevitable response to those 45 years, as you describe it, of U.S. intervention?
No, it's not an inevitable response. It didn't take place for... Actually, the first... there are two things that have to be distinguished. One is the perpetrators and what they're up to, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the groups, apparently, I agree with everyone else, they're the groups that the CIA, British intelligence, and others organized and trained and armed in the 1980s, rounding up radical Islamists from around the world for their own purposes. to, you know, harm the Russians as much as possible.
Noam Chomsky, please hold the other point. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight with MIT linguist and radical political theorist and advocate Noam Chomsky for an alternate view of what's going on since 9/11. Not entirely alternate, Noam Chomsky points out. You can read much of what he's saying in the Wall Street Journal, but there's a lot that you will not, including the notion that the United States is itself a terrorist state. We'll come back and talk about that with Noam Chomsky. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight with radical political theorist and advocate Noam Chomsky, MIT linguist, beloved by the American and the global left, bitterly attacked by his critics, but always with a very challenging view of the world and what's really going on. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Noam Chomsky, we've invited you on because you're challenging, because you help us get perspective, whether we agree with it or not, on what's happening in the world, and we value your comments for that. You were describing first the Al Qaeda and its ilk who have responded to the U.S. and you're saying that there's another layer to
There's two things that we have to distinguish if we want to understand this. One is the perpetrators and what they're up to. In fact, the people who were quoted in the Wall Street Journal despise them.
That is Al Qaeda and the other terrorist groups.
Because they are their main targets. You know, their main target.
That is the elites of the Middle East.
Elite. They want to, and others like them.
And the other layer?
The second layer is the general reservoir of not sympathy for Al Qaeda, but understanding of the message. That's what Eisenhower called the campaign of hatred against us, not from the governments, which we install and support, but from the people. That's very old, and the reasons remain the ones that the National Security Council described almost 50 years ago. And they're understandable. We may not like to think about them, but it's not very wise to hide our heads in the sand.
You certainly don't take that line. In fact, you call the United States itself a terrorist state. This may be common parlance in your neck of the woods, but for most people it's not. Please explain how you come to that conclusion, that description of the United States of America.
Well, it's again a sign of my innate conservatism. This is uncontroversial. The United States is the only country in the world that has been condemned for international terrorism by the highest international authorities, the World Court, which condemned the U.S. for what it called the unlawful use of force in international violent actions. That's international terrorism.
Please give us examples of what U.S. actions you would classify as terrorism.
Same one the World Court did. The U.S. would have been condemned by the Security Council, too, except it vetoed the resolution. In that particular case, I mention it only because it's uncontroversial, it was the U.S. terrorist attack against Nicaragua. The court ordered the United States to terminate the terrorist crimes. The U.S. responded by dismissing the court judgment, vetoing Security Council resolution, instantly escalating the attack, bipartisan escalation, and in fact giving the first official orders to attack soft targets. That means undefended civilian targets.
You're talking about U.S. support for the Contras against the Sandinistas in the early 80s?
Not early 80s. Went on till 1990. Till the election, as the U.S. tried and succeeded, in fact, in dismantling the Central American peace accords.
What other examples would you cite, Noam Chomsky?
Everything else that happened in Central America. I mean, in Nicaragua, Nicaragua was not the worst case. There, the population had an army to defend it. The worst cases were the armies were the terrorists, El Salvador and Guatemala. There were horrendous atrocities carried out by forces backed and armed, trained by the United States, which left a couple hundred thousand people dead.
And I know you have a litany that comes right up to more recent years, including the U.S. cruise missile bombing in the Sudan.
I mentioned that because it's such a minor footnote, even though it probably led to tens of thousands of deaths.
Why do you call that terror, and how do you connect it to tens of thousands of deaths?
Well, I don't do that. I'm just quoting the analyses that have been given. There's been very little investigation because we don't investigate our own crimes. But I was quoting the several tens of thousands figure that I was from the only investigations there have been that I'm aware of.
And this is making the case that the bombing of the pharmaceutical plant in Sudan, by diminishing Sudan's pharmaceutical production capacity, resulted in the deaths of many from tuberculosis and other diseases.
Well, this is not my judgment. It's the judgment of the German ambassador to Sudan, published in the Harvard International Review, of the one specialist on the region who investigated it, the head of the regional director of the Near East Foundation, an old, very conservative, respectable foundation with field experience in Sudan.
Noam Chomsky, what you describe as terrorism, I think Americans are taught to see as a responsible large power keeping order in the world.
Yeah, that's the way all great powers behave. But I'm quite conservative on this. I take the official U.S. definition of terrorism, and I say, let's apply it. So terrorism is the calculated use of the threat or use of violence to attain political, religious, or other goals through intimidation and spreading fear. That's a fine definition. It's happened to quote it from a U.S. Army manual.
9/11 seems to fit that definition.
It certainly does.
Do you see something new, something different in the events of September 11th, Noam Chomsky?
Yeah, totally different.
What is that?
This is a remarkable event in world history. It's the first time in the history of the United States since 1814 that the national territory has been under attack or even threat. For Europe, it's hundreds of years when they have been immune from threat or attack. Meanwhile, the West has been carrying out terrorist atrocities all over the world, but it's been immune from attack.
How do you read the significance of this turn of events?
Well, the significance is that for the first time in hundreds of years, the guns were pointed in the other direction.
And with that, what are now the courses of action? I guess I should say, what were the courses of action open to the United States on September 12th? And given the course that's been taken, how do you interpret the way this is unfolding?
Well, there are a number of ways to respond. Before answering that, I should say that any answer ought to satisfy a minimal condition of moral truism. Namely, if something is right for us, it's right for others. If it's wrong for others, it's wrong for us. I mean, there's a famous definition of hypocrite in the Gospels, which I think we should heed. It defines the hypocrite as the person who applies standards to others but refuses to apply them to himself.
All right, as we describe what's happened, please apply that to us so we see what you mean.
So how do we think that Nicaragua should have responded when the United States was condemned by the World Court for international terrorism and after the condemnation escalated the attack?
Can we put it in terms of the United States and Afghanistan?
Sure. Let's say it's the same story. I mean, if the U.S. response in Afghanistan is correct, if the same response would have been correct for victims of U.S. terrorism.
And what are you getting at there? There's something that you're describing, and be more explicit, please.
Yeah, very explicit. I mean, do you and I believe that Nicaragua should have bombed the United States or maybe set off bioterror, or that Cuba should have or Haiti should have or Panama or many other countries where we've carried out terrorist actions? So, of course, we regard that as outrageous.
So are you then saying that the United States was outrageous in attacking Afghanistan after the 9/11 bombings?
I would suggest that you are saying that, unless you think that the victims of U.S. terrorism should carry it out against us.
Noam Chomsky, take us back at the outset on 9/12. What do you see as the courses of action that were open in the immediate aftermath of those bombings to the United States?
Well, again, taking a conservative position, I'll quote Foreign Affairs, the leading Anglo-American historian, military historian, Michael Howard, the January issue of Foreign Affairs. There's an article he actually wrote a couple of months earlier. He pointed out that in the case of a massive criminal conspiracy, which this clearly was,
on the part of Al-Qaeda?
Yes, presumably. What you do is careful police work to identify the people responsible, then, if it's international, an appeal to an appropriate international authority, that would be the Security Council, to authorize actions to apprehend those against whom evidence has been found, to bring them to trial.
So a policing and judicial path was one alternative.
Yes,
obviously, the other was war.
No, there were others.
All right. How would you describe the rest of the range?
Well, for example, I'd pay some attention to the Afghans. There was, in late October, there was a meeting of 1,000 Afghan leaders under U.S. auspices in Pakistan, Peshawar. This is tribal and political leaders, many of them trekked in from Afghanistan, others there. It was pretty well reported here and highly praised as a serious meeting. They disagreed about a lot of things, but they agreed on one thing unanimously, namely stop the bombing and allow us to continue to act to overthrow the Taliban regime from within. That was also the view of the major Afghan women's organization, RAWA. It was also the view of the U.S. favorite, Abdul Haq.
It clearly wasn't the view of the United States in Washington. The U.S. went in. The Taliban was thrown out. Do you see the events of the fall as a success for U.S. foreign policy in responding to 9/11, Noam Chomsky?
First of all, overthrow of the Taliban regime was not a war aim. Let's be clear about that. The war aim, announced very clearly by President Bush about a week after the bombing started, was a front page of the New York Times, told the Taliban, we're going to continue to bomb you. We've told the Afghans, not the Taliban, we're going to continue to bomb you until you hand over to us people we suspect of carrying out the terrorist atrocities, but we're not going to present you with any evidence, and we're not going to accept any approach for negotiations. That was the official position.
But obviously that was quickly surpassed.
Not quickly. On a first reference, a later war aim, after 3 weeks of bombing, first reference I found is October 28th, this is from the British Secretary of Defense, Minister of Defense, Chief of Defense Staff, Admiral Boyce, also on the front page of the New York Times, informing the Afghans that we will continue to bomb you until you get your leadership changed. That's after 3 weeks of bombing.
Noam Chomsky, our time is short, and I want to push ahead. Let me ask you this. What do you think will be the consequences of the path the United States has chosen in its response to September 11th?
Well, there are a lot of consequences. One consequence, a major consequence, is probably a disaster for the population of Afghanistan, but that we'll never know because it requires investigation, and we won't carry it out. The major visible response is that the U.S. has begun to establish what looks like a permanent military base in Central Asia and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and other surrounding regions. That's new. It's had military bases all over the world, but not in Central Asia before. And in doing so, it's supporting regimes like the Uzbekistan regime, which are barely distinguishable from the Taliban.
The long-term consequences of that kind of alliance?
The long-term consequences are complicated. I mean, this is an extension of what used to be called the Great Game in the 19th century. Then it pitted the British Empire against the Russian Empire over this region. A lot of wars and fighting. Now it's sometimes called a new Great Game. And the main concern is the energy resources and other resources of the region. And everyone's trying to get a piece of it.
Noam Chomsky, we have a mountain of callers that want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Listeners, do you recognize the America Noam Chomsky describes? Does 9/11 make more sense in Noam Chomsky's view of the world or less? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Alan is on the line. Good evening. Welcome, Alan.
Good evening. Noam, I would put before you the premise that the fact that U.S. Gets involved in places like Afghanistan and deeply involved the Pakistani government as well as Israel modifies these governments' behavior so that they're able to deal with terrorists within their midst. For example, Pakistan has just dismantled the entire Kashmir and Afghanistan ISI units because the U.S. is involved over there. Now, if the U.S. had not been involved, these terrorist units would not be dismantled and possibly encouraged and even may have had a coup in Pakistan, we'd have a much deeper problem.
So, Alan, you're saying, Alan, the U.S. is not a terrorist state, but an anti-terrorist state in that
That's
way.
Correct. That's correct.
Noam Chomsky?
Half correct. The U.S. is opposed to terrorism directed against itself and its clients, but it is in favor of terrorism carried out by itself and its clients. And in this respect, it's like every other power. It's not unique. And if you want to take the cases you mentioned, In the case of Israel, the United States is, for the last 25 years, has been acting to enhance terror and is continuing to do so right at this moment. I'll give you the examples if you like. In the case of Kashmir, you talked about half the situation, but there's another half. The other half is that I just spent a month in India and a couple of days in Pakistan talking about this and infuriating everyone on both sides.
Conservative as you are, Noam Chomsky.
What I told them is what is true, that the charges that each side makes against the other are correct.
But Noam Chomsky, when an Israeli hears this comment and they all know about suicide bombings in Israeli shopping malls, and of course it goes both ways, it must be hard for them to see themselves as terrorists, or at least certainly themselves as not victims of terror.
Well, not if they read their own newspapers. Most of what I write about this is taken from the leading Israeli newspapers. So Haaretz, the major newspaper, quite openly and regularly describes, and for many correspondents, deplores long-standing Israeli terrorism. Remember that for 35 years, it's not a symmetry, it's an asymmetry. Most of this is going on in the occupied territories. These are territories under military occupation. For 35 years, it's been harsh and brutal, with extensive U.S. diplomatic and military support. Israel has been able to expand into the territories before any suicide bombings took place, before anything was going on inside Israel.
But at this point, a lot of death on both sides.
Look, before any of this happened, the West Bank had been divided by the U.S. and Israel into a couple of hundred isolated cantons, little sections, some of them a few square kilometers. Amnesty International estimated 227. This is an extension of the policy of grinding the Palestinians down, devastating the economy, crushing them. Israel tells you exactly what it's doing. All we have to do is read what they say. The leading negotiator for Ehud Barak, Shlomo Ben Ami, who's considered a dove in the Israeli context, also an academic historian. He wrote about it in Hebrew, of course. Just 2 years ago, he said the goal of the Oslo process is to create a permanent neocolonial dependency in the occupied territory.
But Noam Chomsky, you know that this view infuriates Israelis who see themselves fighting for a homeland and wanting peace to live there.
They don't. Shlomo Ben Ami, I'm quoting Shlomo Ben Ami. This is the occupied territories. It's not Israel. 25 years ago, 1976, there was a Security Council resolution debated calling for a two-state settlement on the international border, including all the wording of UN 242, main resolution.
We understand the history, Noam Chomsky, but it's...
You don't understand the history because you don't even know this.
Well,
you know that the United States vetoed that resolution?
Yes, I mean, it's...
Do you, really?
Well, it's all on the record.
Where did you find it out?
Well, like you, many of us have spent some time reading and looking into this.
Fine.
But what's striking is...
But tell me what the meaning of that is. If the United States alone in the world vetoed a peaceful diplomatic settlement, and incidentally has been doing so consistently from then till the present, that's significant.
Noam Chomsky, we've got to take a break. We'll come right back. Listeners, do you recognize the America that Noam Chomsky describes? Do Americans keep themselves willfully ignorant of the costs of U.S. foreign policy? Do you understand what Noam Chomsky is getting at when he calls the United States a terrorist state? Are you enlightened or outraged? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Noam Chomsky, the MIT linguist and radical political theorist and advocate who turns a blind eye on nothing. No one is cut any slack in Noam Chomsky's world. The label terrorist, he's willing and ready to apply to Al-Qaeda, if indeed that's who's behind 9/11. But he's also ready to apply it to the United States when cruise missiles land on pharmaceutical plants in Sudan. Do you recognize the America that Noam Chomsky describes? And is this an urgent conversation for America to be having now? Or should it wait till the war is over? Should it wait forever? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Dave is on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, if we're ready to blame the United States, I think we should be ready to blame any large economy because really, I think the bottom line is this is probably related to oil, probably related to economy, and I just wanted to get your feedback on the fact that, you know, most of the so-called support that we're talking about that the United States has been giving to these different factions is probably really related to the fact that we need the oil, we need these resources which are unfortunately in countries that are hostile to us.
Dave, it's a good and honest question. Noam Chomsky, take us through your logic to the bottom line. How does a superpower, a super economy like the United States, can it exist in the world and stay within the kind of moral boundaries that you'd like to see applied?
First of all, I agree with the main point. The United States behaves like every other power. When England was running the world, it behaved the same way. To the extent that France had power, it behaved the same way. And we can run down the list. Luxembourg would behave this way if they could get away with it.
So can a great power be good?
The United States, first of all, the United States does not need the resources. Right until about 25 years ago, we didn't even use them. But during the period when Eisenhower was talking about the campaign of hatred and the National Security Council was talking about how we want to dominate Near East oil, we were not even using it.
Do you mean we could shelve a lot of SUVs and turn off air conditioners?
No, it had nothing to do with it.
We don't need it, but we have a large...
North America was the major oil producer in the world.
I see.
We were not using Near East oil.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, right now, we could get by on Western Hemisphere oil, and in fact, that is the intention of the U.S. Of U.S. planners. They wanted the oil for a different reason, and they made it clear why.
But Noam Chomsky, be good enough to really go to David's question. It's an honest and simple question.
Yes, I am.
Well, can the U.S. exist with the kind of economy that it has?
Yes, the U.S. existence does not require control of the world's energy resources in order to improve the profits of U.S.-based energy corporations and to hold what George Kennan 50 years ago called a veto power other countries.
Are you saying U.S. power
control over oil?
Is then U.S. power projection arbitrary, or to what
no,
do you attribute it if it's not necessary?
I mean, any power system is very likely to try to expand and extend its power by violent means if necessary, unless its own population controls it.
Let's turn to Matt. Matt, good evening and welcome. You're on the air.
I'm so grateful to get a chance to talk to Professor Chomsky. I feel that there's this superb moral presence at the basis of all of your thinking. You have this prodigious mind, but it's always infused with a profound moral sense. And for me, the America I would like to live in is the America of Professor Chomsky, in which individuals are brought back to their responsibility as much as possible for their own actions. It seems he's advocating a world in which individuals and groups of individuals are fundamentally responsible for the predictable outcomes of their own actions. That seems like something we should have all learned in kindergarten. And more than ever, this world needs to hear this message. And Professor Chomsky holds to this message without flinching in all possible situations with great courage and bravery. I don't want to make you uncomfortable, Mr. Chomsky, but if you would talk about the basis in morality for your approach to this tireless work that you do.
It's just what you said, and it's very simple-minded. I think, yes, exactly as you said, any one of us should take responsibility for the predictable consequences of our own actions. We should not be hypocrites in the sense in which the Gospels defines hypocrites. We should be honest. If we impose standards on others, we should insist, not just agree, insist on imposing them on ourselves. And if we do that, and a lot of people do, we can make it a much better world. I mean, that's why it is a much better world than it was, you know, 200 years ago, or for that matter, even 30 years ago. It's because a lot of people, I would think probably the majority of the population here, do really believe that and have worked for it.
Matt, thank you for your call. Noam Chomsky, you've written that the crime of 9/11 is a gift to the hard jingoist right, those who hope to use force to control their domains. What do you mean by that, and is that coming to pass?
Well, actually, that's something I said in an interview, I think, on September 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it has exactly come to pass.
How so?
Unfortunately. For example, the Russians used the opportunity to intensify their atrocities in Chechnya, now with a degree of U.S. support. China used them to increase its atrocities in Western China. Israel used them to increase its atrocities in the occupied territories. Turkey used them to increase its repression. I've just come back from there, in fact, from a political trial, which is part of that. The U.S. is using it instantly to try, as the Bush administration rams through domestic programs, it knows the population opposes under the plea that you've got demand that you have to be patriotic and shut up. And it runs right through the world. I mean, India is using it. I didn't have a chance to talk about Kashmir, but there's another half to the story there. The main problem in Kashmir has been for 50 years that India has refused to allow the referendum that the UN called for. Finally, by the late 80s, their repression did call up, did elicit resistance. And since then, there have been major Indian atrocities. Now they feel that they have an opportunity to carry out more, and this is going on all over the world.
Point taken. But at bottom, when George Bush describes the war on terrorism as a war for freedom, which he always does, do you buy it?
Look, we can think whatever we like about what's going on, have like it, hate it, whatever you like. It cannot be a war on terrorism. We shouldn't use the phrase. The war is being led by the one country in the world that has been condemned for international terrorism. You mentioned the Sudan, but I never even talk about that because it's just a footnote.
You've written about it extensively, I've seen.
I have one phrase about it. That phrase infuriated people, so I expanded and gave the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But I barely mention it because it's so minor in the record.
As an incident.
There are much worse cases. The other members of the Coalition Against Terror are also terrorist states. I don't have to tell you about Britain's record for a couple hundred years.
So when you say...
Russia, I mentioned why they're joining. Turkey is happy to join because, in fact, they said why. In gratitude because the Clinton administration gave them overwhelming support, in fact, 80% of their arms, when they carried out some of the worst ethnic cleansing and atrocities of the 1990s.
So when you say there are plenty of bin Ladens on both sides,
yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean there are plenty of people who accept the principle that we're going to drive our enemies out of our lands. When bin Laden says it, he means Muslim lands. When George Bush and Tony Blair say it, they mean the world. But the fact that they and their predecessors resort when they feel that they have to extreme violence, torture, terror, that's just on the historical record. We don't have to debate that.
Varda is on the line. Welcome, Varda. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to say thank WBUR for allowing Noam Chomsky to speak out. I'd like to see him more on the media, but unfortunately I don't think that's going to happen. My concern is how easily the American people are manipulated, and you know, while they're waving their flags about this incredible war, you know, Bush is behind the scenes raiding the Treasury, and all the facts that Mr. Chomsky talks about are not—they're not secrets. You know, the war in El Salvador and all these things that are publicized. And I just wonder, you know, why the American people have taken such an incredibly ignorant and passive position, and not don't seem willing to look at the facts and to take responsibility. What's his thinking on this?
Varda, thank you for your call. Yeah. Noam Chomsky.
Actually, I have a much more positive feeling about the general population. I mean, I think what you're saying is true of intellectual elites, educated elites, hence it's true of what you read. But I don't think it's true of what's happening among the population. I mean, take, say, El Salvador. It's not very well understood, but in my view at least, the popular domestic opposition to U.S. atrocities in Central America in the 1980s broke totally new ground in the entire hundreds of years of history of imperialism. There was never a time in European imperialism or in our own imperial ventures when people right in the mainstream, you know, churches in Kansas and so on, went down to live with the victims.
Have you seen that echoed post-9/11 by your lights, Noam Chomsky? But the country's been awash in American flags that seem to signal support for President Bush's war on terror.
That's what the headlines tell you. What's in fact going on is that there is more openness, questioning, concern, dissent than at any comparable stage of any other international conflict. And it's particularly remarkable because this is the first time that the U.S. was itself attacked.
Henry's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Henry. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Dr. Chomsky, it's an honor to talk with you. I'd like to also comment to the host point. As a powerful nation, our nation, why would it need to go over and use that power in a way? I mean, great power works with what it has. If we're going to, I don't see us as a great power right now. I don't see us spreading out and in such a needy way, in such a needy manipulative way, and being able to be considered a great power at the same time. And also, my second and last point is, as I heard Dr. Chomsky comment on how the investigation will not be done. Noam, do you see that as the root of how information doesn't get back?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just us, but almost no one investigates their own crimes. I mean, if we had time, I could run through a very interesting historical record on this, including Britain and every other state. Ours too. On your first point, though, I think you've hit on a very important point. I mean, we talk about the United States as if it's an entity. It isn't. The United States has internal conflicts. There are segments within the United States who do gain substantially by the exercise of American violence. Most of the population loses by it. I mean, take, say, the war in Vietnam. I mean, there undoubtedly were beneficiaries among U.S. power centers. The corporate world, for example, benefited. It helped, and they knew it. It helped them maintain control over Southeast Asia. Sure wasn't beneficial to the 60,000 Americans who were killed there, or plenty of others.
Henry, thank you for your call. Noam Chomsky, our time is really growing short. There's one point I want to get to. It has been widely said that the 9/11 was a response to globalization, and I think you've disputed that. Give us your thinking there.
I think that is outlandish. First of all, bin Laden probably never heard of globalization. The same attempt was made in 1993, remember. And we have the people in jail who they think did it. I mean, some Muslim cleric from Egypt. Did he ever hear about globalization?
But the notion is widespread that we're spreading our culture around the world, and this is eliciting a kickback.
In 1958, when Eisenhower and the National Security Council were discussing the reasons for the campaign of hatred against us, did that have to do with globalization? I mean, this is just an excuse. It's an effort by intellectuals to try to evade their own responsibility. We know the reasons. The reasons are clear, and it has nothing to do with globalization. Furthermore, globalization itself is a pretty fraudulent term.
So you would say it's the projection of U.S. power that this is a response to?
It's the way the power is used. When the power is used, as the National Security Council described it 45 years ago and still today, to support corrupt and brutal regimes which undermine democracy and development, yeah, that'll lead to a campaign of hatred against us.
Noam
it's
Chomsky,
not good for Americans.
You always raise the tent pole a little higher, whether we like it or not. Tell us about your recent visit to Turkey. The publisher that you were involved with there was headed to prison. You went and said to the court, make me a defendant too, and he was released. Is that right?
Yeah, but, you know, I don't deserve any credit for that. I mean, look, people like you and me are safe. The people who deserve credit are the very courageous and honorable Turkish intellectuals who are putting themselves on the line, writers, journalists, artists, and others, to try to overcome the really draconian freedom of speech laws that are applied very harshly. And they're applied because the U.S. government supports it. I also, incidentally, went to southeastern Turkey, to Diyarbakir, the center of the Kurdish areas, where millions of people are living in a dungeon, you know, having been driven out of the devastated countryside, which you and I paid for with our taxes.
Noam Chomsky, we're out of time, and I'm sorry for that, but we thank you for coming on tonight, for sharing your singular view of the world, and for expanding our boundaries a little bit in the process. Thanks very much for coming on.
Okay.
Listeners, you can read articles written by Noam Chomsky by visiting our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.